higher performance and faster and more reliable.
Good evening and welcome to Open Paddock episode 243 for Tuesday, August 5th, 2014. Tonight on the show, Bernie gets out of trouble the only way he knows how. He pays a bribe. Conway is getting a start in WC at COTA. And guess what? The Nasty is brewing. Milka Duno is in Nationwide because they need more airbags. In IndyCar, Dixon bags the field at Mid-Ohio. With three races left, the season is heating up, and we will start talking about the season for next year because we have some minor details on the schedule for 2015. In Rally, WRC Finland review and premium content on the web for WRC, Get a Clue F1, and some other news for Global Rallycross and World Rallycross, the FIA's version of a Subaru Impreza. This is Open Paddock. All right, guys, good evening. Welcome to the show. This is Mike Weisel. I am your host for this evening's festivities. Tonight, I am drinking one of America's finest ales. I am drinking Arrogant Bastard. From the description on the bottle, this is an aggressive ale. You probably won't like it. It's quite doubtful that you have the taste or sophistication to be able to appreciate an ale of this quality and depth. We would suggest that you stick to safer and more familiar territory, maybe something with a multi-million dollar ad campaign that convincing you it's made in a little brewery or one that implies that their tasteless yellow fizzy beverage will give you more sex appeal.
I like the label, and yes. I did have one of those a couple months ago on the show.
Oh, I love these
things.
They're
rather tasty.
It's good stuff. It is an assertive and aggressive ale, so if you're not into a little bit of extra hoppiness in your ale, this is a strong American ale that may not be in your palate. But if you lean towards the dark side of hoppiness, this might be your ticket to newfound enjoyment in the realms of beer. And I will pass the torch on over to Mike Shaw. Mike Shaw, how are you this evening, and what are you drinking?
I'm doing very well this evening. I have one of the Northwest's favorites here, the good old Dead Guy Rogue Ale.
Very nice.
Say, dedicated to the rogue in each of us. So it's just an old standby. It's always flavorful, not quite as hoppy, but just a good smooth flavor and a good brew.
Very nice. And also on the show this evening is John Olsakovsky. John, we welcome you from the warmer realms of Houston, and we would appreciate if you would tell us what you're imbibing.
Finishing off the last of that bottle of Three Olives Cherry Vodka in some Sprite Zero this evening.
Oh, very nice. Very nice. Well, we've got a bunch to cover on the show tonight. Yes, Doug and I were at Mid-Ohio this weekend. Doug will not be joining us on the show because he has SCCA monthly meeting tonight and cannot be part of the podcast. But we were at Mid-Ohio, so we'll talk a bit about Mid-Ohio with IndyCar. We have a little bit of mixed motorsport news to cover before we kick off the show. A little F1, some WC, some Nationwide stuff. And after that, we'll go into IndyCar. We'll talk a little bit about the Mazda Road to Indy races from this weekend. It was a super full slate for them as they ended up with seven races total in the Mazda Road to Indy slate. And then we jump into a yumptastic review of Rally Finland. And Mike has some other cool stuff to talk about from the WRC side and Rally in general. So plenty to cover, and let's get right to it. In the mixed motorsports segment of the show, the unintelligible things that we will talk about this evening, we start off with Bernie Ecclestone. In Formula One, Bernie has managed a plea agreement with the prosecution in his bribery case or whatever. Okay, if you're not familiar with it, let me give you a recap. Very brief. There's this German banker that claims that Bernie paid him a bunch of money to ensure that when shares of F1 were sold, they were sold to CVC Capital Partners so that Bernie could continue running F1. Because
we're talking tens of millions of dollars he paid to this guy.
He had $44 million U.S. dollars.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Since he was a representative of a nationally owned German bank that was selling those shares, that's pretty bad things. this German banker went to jail for accepting this bribe from Bernie. Turns out Bernie says, well, it wasn't a bribe for him to sell F1 to, you know, to the people that I wanted him to. What it really was I was paying him off so he wouldn't blab to the authorities about tax issues. But there's nothing wrong with my tax issues. You know, he's got a trust fund that's worth billions of dollars, and if he was shown to be in charge of the trust fund, then he would be liable for massive amounts of taxes. Anyway, Bernie claims this banker was shaking him down for money so he wouldn't blab about these tax issues, which didn't really exist, but Bernie just didn't want to go through the trouble of fighting them.
Yeah, right, whatever.
Exactly, whatever. Any way you look at it, Bernie's paying a bribe, to this banker, which makes you think that's an admission of guilt to begin with. If you're willing to pay a bribe, this is Bernie Ecclestone. You don't shake him down for money. He puts horse heads in your bed. It goes the other way around. So, very odd situation. Bernie has been on trial in Germany since March over this issue about paying a bribe to a German banker in German courts. They have come to some sort of plea agreement. It sounds like Bernie will pay $100 million to be let off.
So paying a bribe to
pretty much
get out of a bribe.
Yeah.
Well, what was it? What was it? Was it last week or maybe it was the week before where Bernie basically told the court, hey, how much money is it going to take to make this go away? He just asked them that, and apparently they came up with a number. And
isn't it ridiculous? Because here's the thing. Supposedly in this plea agreement, which involves him paying a bribe to the German court, only in Germany, because we can't do that in America. We can't pay money to a federal prosecutor to make charges go away. That's kind of bad things. Anyway, pays to be rich, I guess.
I love the quote. The New York Times article about this was quoted as saying the Bernie's lead defense attorney. Apparently, they were asked if they could come up with the $100 million by Friday. He's like, "That's doable.
No problem. we'll just take it right out of the trust fund and send it your way."
It's like I have a hard time coming up with like $20 for my daughter's craft projects for the week.
Yeah, we are talking about Bernie Ecclestone. This is the guy who constantly gets ragged on for the safety of the Brazilian Grand Prix at Sao Paulo in the bad part of town at the racetrack there at Interlagos. And he constantly made comments like, oh, it's super safe to go to Sao Paulo. When I'm in Sao Paulo, I go running on the beach with my Rolex on and my gold chains and everything, and nobody bugs me. It's like, you moron. That's probably because of the entourage of security guards that follow you everywhere you go.
The snipers on the rooftop.
Yeah. Anyway, so Bernie, just go away. Now the question really does come down to, by making this $100 million payment to the German courts to make his bribery trial go away, does that take him out of F1? It's a real question. Supposedly there's no admission of guilt in this $100 million payout. So with no admission of guilt, does CVC still keep Bernie around? Or do they pull him in favor of someone else or some other group or what have you?
Here's what I foresee, I think, is just, you know, I think Bernie's kind of on his way out anyway. I mean, he's an old guy.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think this is an opportunity for them to – he'll still be there, but I think he won't be the face. He'll be the puppet master.
Mm.
So they'll work in somebody else, but he'll still be telling them what to do for now.
Yeah, that may be.
At least that would be the logical direction to go. Of course, it is F1. They're not logical, so never mind.
Speaking of escaping logic, Ferrari, they have they fired their engine boss, this Mr. Luca Marmarini. Sorry, all you Italians out there, I just can't do it. But anyway, Luca has been replaced at Ferrari as the head of powertrain development. And he's leaving, and he's going to Renault to help them work on their engine.
So okay, they're getting rid of Luca Marmorini, and they're going to replace him with Mattia Binotto.
Very nice. Many have said.
Wow, we're offending a lot.
No.
Probably. Hey, you know what? I'm Italian, so
there you go.
They can deal with it.
If we want to look at where the engine manufacturers and Formula One stand at this point in the season, who's worse off at this point, Ferrari or Renault? Mm.
That's
Ferrari is actually, because I think the Renault power plant that's in the Red Bulls have shown pretty strong actually.
Yeah, exactly. That's my point. So I don't think this is really good get necessarily for Renault, than the fact that I think it's more of just
he's coming over and saying, "Hey, this is what didn't work at Ferrari. So whatever you're doing, keep doing it.
What not to do." Nice.
But it's in all seriousness, I think it's part of what they're trying to do at Ferrari in cleaning out personnel who have contributed to their dismal performance this year, you know.
Yeah, the hard thing is many have said before that the reason Michael Schumacher was successful at Ferrari is they brought in a massive team of non-Italians to run that team. They brought in the Frenchman Jeantaud. They brought in Ross Braun. He's German. is he German? He's not German. He's English. Anyway, they brought in all these outside dudes to help run the team, and when it went back to the Italian way, there were a lot of people that said, yeah, you know, that probably wasn't the best idea, letting it go back to what it was. So, not saying anything against the Italians, but just saying that there is a greater mind share of knowledge centered in the British Isles on how to run an F1 team.
Oh, would agree.
Mr. Mike Conway has been confirmed to be in for a P1 seat at the WEC race at Austin.
Woo-hoo! Well, hasn't he proven his ability to run circuit courses, you know? I mean, yeah,
indeed.
No doubt. It
earned. That's all I can say is earned.
Yeah. So we've got...
I am planning on being there, so I'm very much looking forward to that.
Oh, that'd be cool.
Yeah, very cool. He will be taking the place of Kazuki Nakajima, who has a Super Formula conflict in Japan. His teammates will be Alex Wurz and Stefan Sarrazin in the number 7 entry for the Toyota TSO40 hybrid. Very cool. I mean, that's a phenomenal piece of equipment.
It sure is. You know, watching it at Le Mans and, compete against the Audi and, you know, them against the Porsche, and seeing that those three manufacturers with their three different concepts, it's just neat.
Yeah. Well, just even if you don't count the hybrid workings of the Toyota, just the fact that they have, you know, 1,000 horsepower on tap, that's kind of cool. I'll take it.
Do you remember when IndyCar used to have that?
Yeah.
He says with a sigh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Saying with a sigh, that's a good segue. All of the nationwide drivers, the NASCAR nationwide drivers, should be prepared to be able to catch towels thrown in anger shortly. Because one Milka Duno is going to be, yes, she's going to be running select nationwide series races. You know, she's been running ARCA for a while. And she is going to be running some select nationwide races. It's really not worth talking a whole lot about this because we all know that this isn't going to go very well.
Oh, yeah.
No.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
The Venezuelan superstar.
Yes.
Maybe there. I don't know about here.
from the press release, quote, "A successful driver has completed in multiple racing series. Duno has 8 major race wins in the highest classes in American Le Mans and Grand American Rolex Series, and the highest finish ever by a female driver at the 24 Hours of Daytona in the now 52-year history of the race." It's like, yeah, they put her in for a 2-minute stint.
I was going to say, yeah. What yeah, stint in the middle of the night that nobody cared about?
You know, you have the start and park NASCAR drivers, and I mean, she would be perfect for that because she could never even get up to speed to be able to keep from getting lapped by lap 5 in some of these IndyCar races.
She just get a black flag for slow lap speeds and park it at that point.
Well, she was in IndyCar for 4 years, and it wasn't until the last year that she was in IndyCar that they really started to clamp down on it, because she and Marty Roth were in IndyCar series at the same time, and they were both terrible. Mm-hmm. And they would go out there, and the rest of the field would lap them over and over again, and they were this constant moving chicane. And, you know, here's Marty Roth, who's funding his own team, going out there, and people are just lambasting him with what he deserved, ridicule, because he was terrible. And they were saying, well, you really need to get another driver in for your car. Keep running your team, but you need a different driver. And finally just folded up and left. It was sad, but it was definitely a time in IndyCar's history when they needed more drivers, and they didn't want to turn away absolute craptacular drivers that should have been black flagged within the first 3 laps of any race they ever competed in. Sorry.
And Milka she's funded by Argentinian oil money.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, the Venezuelan oil money. She's PDVSA was part of her and Citgo.
Yeah, and Citgo. Yeah, and she has apparently, as I understand it, some close ties to Hugo Chavez himself. Read into that.
Are they going to still be saying that, you know, they just topped off the car with Sunoco fuel every time that she pits?
Sure, they will.
Well, yeah, because that's the fuel they use.
Right, exactly. So it's like, okay, so
I don't think she'll actually run Citgo colors or branding on the car.
Yeah,
Sunoco would allow that, but her money is still coming from the Argentine government and their oil ventures.
Yeah, you know. We make fun of how overrated Danica is, but boy, she is so many leaps and bounds above Danica, or above Milka. I mean, you know, again, yeah, Danica's overrated. She's a good driver, but yeah, she's overrated for what she can do, right?
Yeah.
But even allowing Milka into that series, it's almost a point of dangerous for the other drivers.
Yeah, well,
she brings money.
Yeah, you know, she has been running in ARCA for a while, so maybe she's learned a thing or two of how to keep a stock car from being slow. But I'm not betting on that too much.
Have you ever seen an ARCA race that she's been in?
No, I haven't.
If you had, then you wouldn't have made your prior statement.
Wow, that bad, huh?
Oh, yeah, no better than she was in IndyCar or in the sports car races that I've seen her run in. She's terrible in pretty much everything.
Wow, that's super disappointing because Danica did something. She came in and she used sex appeal to be noticed. But she actually went out and raced some pretty clean races and did a decent job. She wasn't phenomenal, but she was good.
Yep.
She was able to win a race. Yes, fuel mileage, but not. There are a lot of people in IndyCar's history who were decent drivers that never won a race.
Right. She's a mid-pack racer.
One. Yeah. And
there's nothing wrong with that. You know, just to say, God, I wish I had the skills to be a mid-pack racer.
No, certainly not. But the sad thing is this deal with Milka Duno, this is ridiculous. And it sets back the cause of female racers because she's out there
being
awful. And these press releases and people talk about her like she's worth something.
I'm trying to remember back. One of the disappointment things that I remember of, you know, female racers in IndyCar was I can't remember the race. It was like way back in like 2001 or something like that. Sarah Fisher was still racing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Sarah Fisher and
Lynn St. James.
And Lynn suddenly they were under a caution.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just getting ready for the restart. And Lynn goes into Sarah and just both women out. And it looked, and they're in the near the back, and I'm just like, oh, this doesn't look good, you know?
Yeah.
We all know how wonderful Sarah is. She's an amazing team owner. She was a good driver, again, not spectacular.
Yeah.
She's superior as a team owner for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like, don't bring in the idiot just to have another woman in there. It's not worth it.
I mean, you get you raise the quality of the female drivers. You keep doing that. You get the Simona Di Silvestro to run in the series. And
that's awesome. Yes.
Have her replace the people that really don't belong, the Milka Dunos. And honestly, yep. You know, Sarah Fisher was brought along too fast in her career. And the same with Danica Patrick, in my opinion, as well. They could have used a bit more seasoning before jumping into IndyCar, but it was something that could be sold. So they were brought in. Sarah did a passable job. Danica did a better job than Sarah, but she had a lot better equipment than Sarah ever had. So there's really not a way to compare the two easily. I hope to see Simona jump into F1 next year and do great. That would be phenomenal.
I hope so too. Yeah, because we all know that she's an amazing driver.
Simona's
great. And Danica's good.
And Pippa Man.
Don't bring someone like Milka into it.
Pippa Man can stay in the broadcast booth.
Yeah, she is really good actually at broadcasting. I like her in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right.
I don't know her skills over time as well, so I'm not going to comment.
Yeah, I think many people would make those comments
She's
as well.
Better than Milk Duna.
Yes.
Yeah.
Fair enough. All right, that is the amalgamum of mixed motorsport musings. That's all we're going to talk about of that tonight. So let's jump into IndyCar. Mid-Ohio Sports Car Course is a phenomenal venue for IndyCar. Yeah, it's tight. Yeah, it's twisty. There's a lack of passing at times, but really the races have been pretty good the last couple of years. This year's race wasn't an exception. I thought this year's race was quite good.
I love this course. I love that. That is a great, great track. You know, they talk about how it's, you know, tough to pass around. There's actually a couple of great opportunities with those long straights coming into, you know, the tight hairpin there and whatnot.
Yeah.
So it's not as bad as you'd think. And I love when the tires come into play at this track. Mm-hmm. It's a fun one, and it's not too long of a distance. You know, it's just, I think that perfect, everybody has to be on their toes. It's not quite a sprint race, you know, but it's compact, I guess I would say. And so everybody's just on the limit the whole time. And I think it's a great race.
The other thing about it is, if you hear it from the drivers, the drivers say it's fun to drive. Fun to drive sometimes makes for not quite fun to race necessarily. Mm-hmm. And I think, that's where some of the complaints are. Some of the courses perhaps a little too narrow. But,
yeah, I guess a little widening of spots might help, but yeah. I love the elevation change, especially. Turn 5 where you just can't, it's a blind crest, I mean, which happens every day in a rally car race, but, you know, you have that, you know, blind crest that they're coming over, and you just don't know, and there's that drop on that other side, you know?
The cars get light as they come up over the crest.
Exactly.
No grip on the other side. Love it.
That's a
This would be IndyCar's yump.
Yeah. It's a super fun place to sit during, you know, Friday and Saturday and watch people figure out the line through that corner, because you see people going sideways through that corner. And this just wasn't IndyCar this weekend. It was IndyCar. Indy Lights had 2 races. USF 2000 had 3 races. Pro Mazda had 2 races. You had the Pirelli World Challenge out there with both groups of classes, the GT classes and the touring car classes. So each of those groups had 2 races each with all the qualifying and everything. So there's tons of action.
How did you have time to go to the bathroom with all that action going on?
Well, and that would be one of my complaints about Mid-Ohio. Don't have a whole lot of bathrooms.
You have people putting in catheters so they don't miss anything.
Well, and then throw in that if you go out there for the weekend, the World Challenge paddock is free. You can go in without paddock pass.
Once again, World Challenge is just amazing. That is one of the many reasons that makes it superior to many forms of motorsport.
Super spectator-friendly. They have a really nice program that they print up at the beginning of the year. It includes shots of all the cars and a description of the teams and the drivers. And, you know, World Challenge has so many different manufacturers represent. Just in the GT classes, you've got Mercedes, you've got McLaren, you've got the
Bentley,
Dodge Viper, you got the Bentleys, you got the Corvettes, you've got the Cadillac CTSVs. golly,
Aston
there's just
Martin.
The
Aston Martin. You got the Lamborghini Gallardo.
The Lamborghini. That's and then you go through the rest of them. There's Mustangs and there's Fiestas and there's
and believe it or not, turbocharged Kia Optimas.
Yes, Honda Fit, Honda Civics. It's just wide range of
everything.
All this stuff. And if you're in the touring car B class, the car on that track, the difference between it and what you can buy in the showroom is a roll cage and different brake pads.
Yeah, the TCA and TCB classes are not too far from the showroom.
But so you've got this awesome program, and everywhere throughout the grounds, there's a box of them sitting there. You know, leaving a bathroom, there's a box of them sitting there. Sitting beside a concession stand, there's a box of these programs
sitting there. It was the same way at Barber, too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, what, quarter-inch thick, maybe a little bit more than that, glossy paper.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually
very
nice production.
Yeah, super nice. All of their races are available on the internet. You can go to YouTube and like their channel, or you can go to their website and see all the YouTube videos.
You can watch
there.
The live video stream right off their website.
You can watch the live video stream.
It is so brilliant because and they don't even have a big TV program, right? Mm-hmm. They do show it on NBC Sports, right? Or is maybe I don't know if it's Fox One or NBC.
They'll show
it like a month later.
Yeah, a few weeks
after the race.
They'll show a condensed version of the race of, you know, because you usually have four races on a weekend, and they'll condense that all down into one 1 hour highlight package or a couple one-hour packages and put them out there. But then the whole race is available on YouTube if you want to go see it.
Right. So here's the thing, and I've been progressively watching all of these races through YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
It's full HD. It's beautiful. The coverage, the announcers are great. Now, here's the funny thing. You have with things like WRC or with the IndyCar and all stuff, and they keep saying, we need TV, we need TV, we need TV to get these sponsors. And yet, look at those cars in this Pirelli World Challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Their TV package, frankly, sucks. WRC has complained that they don't get, by the time the stuff comes out on TV, it comes out too late. Then, you know, people already know what the results are. So, you know, it's not exciting for TV, and that's not really attractive. So we're going to change our format, right, to make a better TV product so we can entice these sponsors. But the thing is, look at this Pirelli World Challenge. Their only live coverage is on the internet. Right?
Yeah.
So, and yet they've got this package of stuff, like you said, this program and all this. They're naming off who all the sponsors are whenever the cars go by and all that stuff. And they always ask these guys that when new people come in, why Pirelli Challenge? Why have you joined into our series? Well, we think you guys have the best thing to attract sponsors.
Yeah.
Like, see, the sponsors have learned internet is okay. Why can't everybody else figure this shit out?
Racing in the GTA, the amateur class this weekend in a Lamborghini Gallardo, whatever that word is, freaking Italians.
Hey, wait a minute. I'm Italian, damn it.
You're going to wake up with a horse head in your bed there, Mr. Weitzel.
Nice. But anyway, racing in the GTA class was Prince Albert von Thurn and Taxis from Germany.
Yes.
Nice.
Yes, that is one of the drivers in one of the GT class. Yep.
So it's just very interesting stuff. Great racing. One of the problems this weekend was Saturday had crazy inclement weather. We had about a 1.5 hour massive downpour in the middle of the afternoon, and it started during one of the World Challenge GT races, and it kind of made it so it really wasn't a race. It was actually quite funny because the cars that were out there on track, they were slotted into a certain order, and the track went yellow due to slide-offs because the rain had started. And the slide-offs kept continuing to happen because nobody wanted to go into the pits to change tires to the rain tires because they'd be giving up track position, and they knew this race was going to get red flagged. So they're going around
tactics.
Behind the base car, and all these cars just continue
they're
to
just
slide
running.
Off and slide off. So
it was
a bit of a war of attrition. fun stuff. But we're not going to dig in too deep into the World Challenge standings because we have so much other stuff to talk about. Jump onto World Challenge's website, hit up their YouTube channel, and watch some of it. Specifically, watch the touring car race, the second touring car race from Saturday. Really good stuff. The Miata and the Honda Civic that were leading the race for the whole time, battling back and forth, lap after lap. They would retake the position in the next lap. lap they'd come around, the other one would take the spot. And the Miata is just this tiny little thing that's about half the height of the Honda Civic because it's this tiny little sports coupe. It didn't have the horsepower to stay ahead of the Civic, but in the tight twisty bits, it probably weighed about half as much as the Civic, so
is able to carry its speed through the corners so, better.
Lots of fun racing. This series produces phenomenal racing. It's a great support event. They're 50-minute races, each of them, and you just honestly, you can't get a better racing package, especially with the manufacturer involvement, the cars that you recognize and can go by all the way through the class, you know. Just good stuff, good stuff. But with IndyCar, to race first you must qualify, is that the phrase?
That's right, there you go.
Anyway. Yeah. Qualifications were an interesting affair because qualifications were done in kind of nasty conditions on a drying wet track. And as far as qualifying goes, there's all kinds of enjoyable things to see through it. But the top six from qualifying is really what we want to talk about, who was able to transfer out of out of the individual qualification sessions. Sebastian Bourdais ended up qualifying on pole, ahead of Sebastian Saavedra, who qualified second. Is that right? That's not right.
No, that's not right.
That's the final. Yeah, I've got the wrong. Sorry. Nice. I've got the wrong thing on my page. Let me pull up the qualifying results because Newgarden qualified second. Okay, there we go. I've got the right stuff now.
If Sean were here, he would have fired you for that.
Yes, he would have, but he's not here. He fired himself.
That's right.
Sebastian Bourdais ended up qualifying on pole. Second was Joseph Newgarden. Tony Kanaan was in there as well. Carlos Munoz qualified fourth. Ryan Hunter Ray fifth. Will Power sixth. Now, the interesting thing to note from all of that is Hunter Ray and Will Power are in the title fight. And going into this race weekend, Hunter Ray was a bit behind, quite a bit behind both Will Power and Elio Castroneves. So that was something to watch. Elio didn't have the best of qualifying attempts. He ended up qualifying 15th. And, we'll talk about him more in a bit. The other championship hopeful would have been Simon Pagenaud, who qualified 9th. So good result for him. But qualifying was interesting, like I said, on a bit of a wet and deteriorated track because the rain came through and washed off all that rubber and made it difficult for everybody.
And some of the strategy that they were employing put Scott Dixon at the rear of the grid.
Mm. Yeah, do you know exactly what put him at the rear of the grid? Were they just trying to stay to not put on reds, or what was their deal?
I was not exactly certain, but he didn't make a lot of laps in his initial qualifying session, and the laps he did turn were just not quick laps. And I don't know if it was a mechanical issue that they didn't go any further, or if there was something else. But yeah, he ended up starting dead last.
Yeah. Well, some interesting things from the race then, because we will start to talk about that at this point. First off was Elio on the formation lap. His throttle sensor kept him from even coming out to take the formation lap. Bad deal for him. Very unfortunate. And
his weekend went from bad to worse because it was, after qualifying on Saturday, his weekend was already rough. That just sealed the deal.
Though good on him because, he went down a few laps there at the beginning. This throttle sensor issue kept him from taking the start. They had to start his car again a little bit later in the race, but he still only finished one lap down. Now, he was at the tail end of the of the results, but he still finished only a lap down, which is pretty impressive as far as that goes. Now, there are three cars that ended up failing to finish the race, so he got points ahead of them. But in the end, his ability to finish I'd said one lap down. He is four laps down. Sorry. But his ability to come out and finish four laps down and stay on at least got him some points. Now, you can't talk about the start of this race without talking about what happened to Tony Kanaan.
Yeah, big bummer for him.
Okay, not turn one, but the entrance to the S is there in front of China Beach, is really the first at-speed corner because they start on the backstretch at Mid-Ohio after the keyhole.
Right.
So they're coming down the backstretch, coming into the corner. Tony's kind of fluttering back and forth on the track to try and find his line. He ends up deciding to try and go inside of Joseph Newgarden.
Well, Joseph had chosen outside. He was inside originally, right? And he chose outside, then came back towards the inside.
Yeah, but I will agree. Joseph came back in. It looked like he was kind of on a standard racing line taking that.
True.
As if
he thought nobody else was there, that would be the line that you would take. But that close to the start, yeah, everybody was mostly still side by side.
Yeah, so I don't think he specifically gave Tony a lot of room there. I think Tony could have made it if he wowed up a little bit more. But
yes, I agree.
Because Tony ended up, he ended up breaking loose the rear end of the car going, around. And
he hopped the curb first, which helped that happen. So he lost all traction once the car was – he tried to keep away from Newgarden, which is kind of coming down, like you said, the racing line. And so he tried to cut in to where that big curb is, and this isn't a curb you can just run over. And it popped the car up. And when it came back down, as soon as you put any throttle down, it's just breaking loose, and that's when he spun.
Yeah. Though it's not a corner you can easily hop over, but it's a whole lot of fun to watch those little Fiat 500s and Honda Fits try and take that curb, because they get all bent out of shape. It's quite fun.
I bet.
So Tony came around, and he was a dead duck in the middle of the track. Marco Andretti hit him pretty much head-on, side pod to side pod, ended both of their races immediately. Also kind of caught up in the schmozzle was Takuma Sato, who drove a bit wide to get away from it, but he sustained a little bit of damage from it.
A lot of people had to go through the grass and even through the gravel. And it's amazing because Doug got a great picture just right there. He was looking at the exit of the corner. Let's see. I see Conway. I see Saavedra. I see, I believe that's Will Power. I believe that is Carlos Munoz. There's another car that I can't identify. Plus, there were others that had to go through a bit of the debris field in the back. What I don't know if you were able to see this, but they pointed out on TV is, Hinchcliffe coming through there was masterful, just weaving his way through,
talk about threading the needle
and the debris. It was brilliant. It mind-bogglingly brilliant. He was able to gain a lot of track position.
He passed,
just as a result of that.
He passed 10 cars on the first lap.
Mm-hmm.
He started 17th and passed 10 cars on the first lap.
It was phenomenal because he was right there in the middle between two cars where you normally don't want to be. But yeah, due to that incident in front of him and just his position, they had to break and there was a whole slot for him to go in. He got around the debris and just came right out in front of everyone.
Yeah.
Some had to go onto the grass, but he went around the other way and stayed on the tarmac and was able to accelerate ahead and get that position.
Move around some debris or something like that. But other than that, yeah, it was like everything just opened up in front of him. It was a thing of beauty.
Yeah. So was Joseph to blame on this one, or was this a racing incident?
The thing is, I'm going to call it kind of a racing incident. He's not a rookie, but he's still young.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just he didn't have the knowledge to just assume that somebody would have been there after that. It was near the start. He should have assumed that somebody would have been in that spot on that corner. And he didn't do so. I don't know if he just didn't see him because there is the elevation change and all that stuff coming out of coming into that corner and stuff. So it was probably just a racing incident. He should have known better, but now he knows for next time.
What's your point, John?
I was going to say, how can it be kind of a racing incident? It either was or wasn't, I think.
That's a fair statement.
I think it was just a racing incident. I don't think anybody did anything wrong. The way things played out, that's what happened.
My opinion, it was Joseph's corner. and Tony was risking himself by trying to peek in on the inside like he did. But that said, it's the start of the race. You, as a driver, Joseph Newgarden, need to realize somebody is going to try and peek in on the first lap of the race, on the first corner of the race. With that in mind, you're kind of risking your entire race on the hope that somebody doesn't spear you coming through that corner. Maybe you should have gone a little wider. No, I'm not pitting the blame on Joseph. I think it was a racing incident. I think both of them could have been a little bit more judicious on how they took that corner. But in the end, it ended Tony Kanaan's race, painted up in his Glad trash bag car.
Yeah. You know, and you know, that's why I said it was kind of a racing incident, because I think both of them could have made better decisions. You know, I think that Kanaan could have braked a little bit harder, you know, a little bit earlier, like you said, yeah. And Newgarden should have just assumed in that corner that someone was going to be there. In the end, yeah, it wasn't really anybody's fault. It was technically, yeah, Newgarden's corner, I guess, but by a slim margin. There was about six other cars that were side by side that ended up doing the same line that Kanaan was originally on and getting through side by side just fine, you know, other than the spun out car in front of them. So, you know, like I said, learning experience maybe. Indeed. But it ended up not really mattering for Kanaan, though.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Now, this was a fun race with a lot of interesting passing going on. Joseph Newgarden ended up, you know, coming out of that corner in second. As the race went on, he was able to get around Sebastian Bourdais for first. Or at the time, by the time he passed Sebastian Bourdais, it was no longer first, because Scott Dixon came in for an early pit. I think a lot of people saw what happened last year at Mid-Ohio when Charlie Kimball pitted early and was able to dictate the race pace because he pitted early and took the fuel strategy issue completely off the table. I think some people were thinking this race might go green flag for the entire race again this year, even after the first turn mess. And with that in mind, it's a great strategy. Pit early, make sure that you're going to be on a three-stop strategy, and just run the dickens out of the fuel. So Scott Dixon came in. Several other cars came in early to get on that off strategy.
The rest of the back of the field, I think it was, you know, pretty much anyone, you know, 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th, you know.
Yeah. Well, and for Scott Dixon, it's a super valid strategy, because you've got to make track position any way you can, and either hope the yellows fall your way or just out strategy everybody. That's the only way you get to the front at Mid-Ohio. You can't pass.
Because he did start last place, 22nd. Was it?
Yep.
First.
You can't pass your way through the field here. You have to rely on strategy to do a lot of work for you. And he did. Now, when Newgarden finally passed Bourdais, Dixon was in the lead because everybody else had pitted after Dixon, and yeah, it made for an interesting situation. But brings out a fun little incident. Ryan Hunter-Reay, he looked like he had the pace this weekend. He was able to hang with Newgarden. He was able to hang with Bourdais. He looked pretty racy early on, but after his first pit stop around lap 28-ish or something, he was caught speeding out of pit lane. And therefore had to do a drive-through penalty. So that really ruined some championship hopes there for him this weekend, because he had to do well. Elio was floundering in the back. Will Power, he's the guy that he was racing with, and he had to do well. Things just did not work for him this weekend, because later on, after he came out of the pits, after he came out, you know, for his black flag, he spun himself and brought out the second yellow of the race. This was an interesting one, though, because Doug and I were just baffled as to what transpired, because he spun, brought out the yellow, they restarted the car. He gets out there and he's at the front end of the lead lap. He was able to get going before the pace car passed him.
Oh, push it.
Well, sorry, the pace car picked him up. So it was him and then the rest of the field, and he was a lap down behind the pace car.
But he was in front of the leader, so he was effectively at the tail end of the
So he wasn't a lap down really yet.
Wasn't a lap down yet, but he was at the
on the verge.
He was super close. We'll just put it that way. Fairly interesting. When this happens, the way IndyCar handles this in pit stops is the leader's pit, and then the field comes around, and when they come around again, the cars that are the cars that are lapped traffic, which would include, you know, Ryan Hunter-Reay, they pit after the leaders. So they cycle behind the leaders, and the leaders will have no lapped cars between them unless, you know, they choose not to pit. So Ryan Hunter-Reay chose not to pit. So he continues to circulate behind the pace car with the leaders behind him. Then IndyCar gave him the wave around. So he gets to the tail end of the lead lap.
Well, I mean, the wave around would be the same thing, effectively the same thing if he were to pit with the cars off of the lead lap.
No, because if he pits with the cars off the lead lap, he goes down a lap.
So they catch him up, and they get still give him the wave around, but he's not a lap down yet.
No, that's a good point. Yeah.
So if he was
a lap down, I understand what you're saying, but you know, he's not a lap down yet. What the hell?
He made up
one lap of the circuit, or very close to one lap of the circuit.
Yeah.
Effectively,
they gave him a lucky dog, and he was still able to pit because once he came around to the tail end of the lead lap, he's on the tail end of the lead lap down. He didn't go a lap down, and instead of pitting when he should have, when it was the lapped car's turn to pit, he waited to get the wave around, and then he pitted from the tail end of the lead lap.
Now, wasn't the yellow kind of extended because under yellow, who messed up?
No.
Do you remember what I'm talking about here? Because it was just the yellow originally for his spin, right?
I think you're right, but I don't remember. But regardless... No, it wasn't Bourdais. Bourdais didn't.
There should have been some repercussions because he was the one who brought out the stinking yellow in the first place.
He did, but then the yellow extended because somebody else did something.
Well,
I'm trying to remember what that was, but there was somebody that took themselves out during that yellow, making the yellow last much longer. Because there's no way you're telling me all this drama was going on under just his single spin.
You sure it wasn't?
I would
Carlos
Munoz
or
was that who it was? I remember seeing.
I'm just throwing it out because, you know, if your teammate does it, you know, Andretti's known to do some team tactics. Just that's Brian Herta.
Yeah, right.
So Andretti.
I mean, I'm getting old here. You know, I've got Alzheimer's disease. I sometimes can't remember what was going on.
Anyway,
but I remember that there was something else that happened, and then yellow extended.
I just found that very odd because he was allowed to take to the tail end of the lead lap, and then after he was at the tail end of the lead lap, after he elected not to pit, then he came in and pit
from
the tail end of the lead lap, and effectively, you know, he stayed on the lead lap and was still able to pit, and there was no penalty for him spinning. Kind of a frustrating deal. It would have been a bigger deal if, you know, some of the championship contenders just didn't do as poorly as they did. But anyway, let's move on from that. This race was pretty fantastic up at the front, but towards the end of the race, Joseph Newgarden,
heartbreaking,
caught up with Scott Dixon. Dixon had about 12 it had been about 12 laps since Dixon had pitted, and Newgarden had just pitted.
Fresh tires.
They were working together. Newgarden was trying to get past Dixon because he knew that, you know, he had fresher tires and he had more fuel. But he went ahead and stayed behind Dixon because he knew Dixon had to pit soon. I think I said some things wrong. I think it had been 17 laps since Dixon had pitted by the time Newgarden caught up to him. So he knew that Dixon was going to have to pit. Once Dixon went about 28 laps on that stint, maybe a little bit more. I can't remember. Maybe it was 32.
Yeah, they're pitting around lap 30. So
But there was some yellow at the start of that stint, so it extended that just a bit beyond the window that they were normally running. So anyway, he catches up with him, and if he could. All he had to do was wait for Dixon to pit, sprint out some fast laps for about 7 or 8 laps, which I was watching the gap times. It went from 3.4 second gap to Bourdais behind him, brought it up to like 4.6 seconds. So he was expanding that gap on Bourdais, and then he came into pit. Now, I should say there is some foreshadowing to what happened here, because after Newgarden qualified second, I looked at Doug and he looked at me, and we both had the exact same thing in our minds. Great that he could qualify well. We know he can race well, but his team loses it for him in the pits.
That's happened time and again, hasn't it?
I think the exact phrase I said is, it's great that he qualified well, but we know he won't win because his team hemorrhages time in the pits. Yep. So yep. We're all just sitting there, edge of our seat, when he comes into pit. And like, he comes in, gets those tires, gets out, gets in the front of the race, and he wins the race going away. That's what's going to happen. No. He comes into the pit. His jackman, or his tire changer had thrown out his airline too soon. Newgarden ran over the airline, caused the jack man to slip and fall. They couldn't get it up on the jacks until he got up and got that thing plugged in. They fumbled around with the left, with the right rear, had some issues, got it fueled.
Well, the right rear tire guy still had the hose still half wrapped around him as he's trying to undo the freaking tire.
Yeah, that's what ended up taking him down. And he's also apparently the same guy that plugs the air jack in as well. It's kind of a double duty kind of thing.
Right. Okay. The right rear tire guy.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was heartbreaking, and I can only imagine Newgarden sitting there in the cockpit.
Well, can you imagine the feeling of running over that? Oh, because you feel it.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a small bump. So you go into that pit and you feel thump thump.
No.
I mean, right there, you're going, son of a, you know.
Not only did he hemorrhage that time in the pits, then he had to come in for a black flag because he hit pit equipment. Double whammy, kind of.
You were there. Did you have access to like a video board or anything?
Yeah, we were watching
the replays of the pit, what was going on in the pit.
Yeah, I will say yes, I saw that, and I will have to commend IndyCar. Last year when we were watching the video board, it was further away. It was a smaller video board that IndyCar had brought in and set up. And the crawl going across the screen on it was just standard broadcast TV crawl. So we were sitting there. I was trying to get the IndyCar app to work when I could. You know, I could get some things, but usually I was using my stopwatch to figure out gap times because of Charlie Kimball's awesome run last year. But we were using Doug's his Hubble telescope lens on his camera to zoom in and see what the video board said. I mean, it was maddening. This year they not only had a bigger screen, they had it set up a little bit closer to us. It was a bigger screen, and the graphics that they used on it were huge. It was clear it wasn't the television package. It was a dedicated graphics package that was just for at the track. Excellent. Yep. Because the crawl, you could read it with no problems. So fantastic job on their part. But we got to see the pit stop on the board, and we're just like, Doug and I just looked at each other, and we just shook our heads, because this is exactly what we talked about, that they hemorrhaged time in the pits. They just hemorrhaged a race win in the pits. Oh, how awful. How awful for Newgarden. He could have won this race. It's good to know that those who are looking at his talent can see how this race was lost, and it was not him that lost it.
Yeah.
If I were Newgarden, I would be very happy to continue with Sarah Fisher Racing into next year if I couldn't find anything else. But Newgarden needs to be at Andretti or Penske or Ganassi. He needs to be there. He is a good talent, and you don't want to keep him at Sarah Fisher until he just falls out of the sport. Sarah needs to upgrade the quality of her pit crew.
Yep, I think some people need firing.
Ugh. Yeah, I hate to do
that. You never want to say that. That's because you know they work hard. But
it's a great organization. They've done a really good job building that organization. That's what I want to see. I want to see these small teams growing and becoming excellent teams. But they've had a lot of these issues and they need to fix it. So, just painful to watch that. Talking about Hinchcliffe earlier on, he ended up finishing third, starting 17th. Like we said, he passed something like 10 cars on that first lap. Now, quote, this is Hinchcliffe, and this is classic. I just love this. Hinchcliffe said, "I don't know why we bother to race here. They should just give the trophy to Scott on Thursday. I thought I did a good job until I saw a numbnut standing in victory lane. I passed 10 cars on the first lap and thought that was pretty damn good. But he started last and won."
That is brilliant. You can't help but love Hinch. Yeah. I mean, it was a brilliant drive by Hinch, but you just can't do better than what Dixon did there. And he runs out of fuel right there at the end, too.
Yeah.
What a brilliant team in setting that up. I mean, that was well done.
Yeah. What did I say last week?
You said he'd win.
Yeah.
I said JPM would win this race, and he squandered around in about seventh, eighth, ninth in that area for most of the race. He qualified
He came up on some strategy calls to get where he did from further back. And he made some moves. If he could have started mid-pack, he might have been able to contend. But.
Yeah, I was kind of confused by something. He was sitting in sixth, seventh place after he had pitted early with the rest of the rear of the field. And he was sitting in sixth or seventh place. He had made some good passes to get there. And the lead cars, top five or six cars on the lead, they were getting to the point where their fuel window was up and they were going to have to start coming in for pits. So I'm sitting here looking at the IndyCar app, which is really nice. I mean, you can go through and see how many laps it's been since somebody's pit. So it's very nice to have at the track to get that information. It was great that Verizon had really good 4G coverage there this year because they didn't last year. So I will have to commend them on that because it was.
It'd be really nice if Verizon would let users of other carriers download and use the app.
That may be, but users of other carriers did not have data access at the track because you're out in the middle of nowhere.
That's kind of the way it is at Barber, too. Verizon's coverage is pretty good, but everybody else's is lousy.
That's pretty much nationwide. I'm in the land of big trees and mountains. Yeah. And Verizon is pretty much the only one to own unless you're one of the people just likes to be in the, main city valley corridor.
Yeah, and that's part of the benefit of having Verizon as a league sponsor. They bring in equipment for the race begins and set up standalone cell towers just for the event to handle the traffic. So, like I said, last year it was almost unusable for the IndyCar app. This year it was fantastic. I didn't have any issues with it at all. Excuse me. But that said, I was watching that on the IndyCar app, and Montoya, it had been 17 laps since he had pitted. All the other cars were coming into pit from the lead. He was going to take the lead of the race, and then suddenly he pits as well. So I don't know exactly what precipitated him to come into pit at that time as well, because he had already taken his first pit stop. Not sure. I never saw anything. It may have been a tire issue. That was the only thing I could think of.
I don't know. I think part of the strategy was once he had gotten that track position, then let's fall into the same pit strategy as the leading group of cars. And they never mentioned anything on the TV broadcast.
Okay. Now, we'll have to commend Charlie Kimball because he made an excellent pass on Juan Pablo. Just hung it out there, took him through the S's, and it was one of the watching passes through the S's is magical. because if you can get that inside line going into the first corner, even if you're not exactly alongside, if you can get that inside line going to the first corner of the S's complex right there in front of China Beach, you come up that hill, you take that off camber, you stay side by side, and you come down and right under that bridge that they have there at the exit of the S's. Man, if you can be alongside there, you've got the corner. And it's just cool to see these guys go through that whole complex side by side with this off camber over the hill dealio and then ducking down into the pit of the S's there. Man, it's just good racing. So watching that pass was pretty much worth the day, even though I was cheering for Juan Pablo. You know, Charlie made an excellent pass there, and several others did as well, but that stuck out in my mind. Will Power had a bit of a lackluster day. He still managed to climb up to sixth at the end of the race. That was after falling back to 12th, trying to avoid the whole lap one mess that Tony Kanaan and Marco Andretti were involved in. So he fell from, sixth back to 12th. On the first lap and had to fight his way back up. So good on him. It helped him propel himself into the championship lead above Elio. Elio's still right there beside him. But, you know, that's what he has to do to possibly win this championship. I don't think he will. We've talked about that before, and I'm not changing my viewpoint. But, so, in the end, Scott Dixon, as I said in the preview, teabagged the entire field. He just stood right over from and dropped his sack right in their face, because there's just no other way of saying it. You come from, you know, the rear of the field and beat everybody and secure your fifth win at Mid-Ohio. I mean, this is just, he owns this place, and Hinch was right. Why don't they give him the trophy on Thursday?
What I couldn't quite understand is near the end, they're like telling him, you know, he's got to manage that fuel for the stints that he did, right? And yet he was still pulling away.
Yeah.
How does he do that?
He's dang good, and he's he's dang good.
Amazing.
He's out in clean air in front of the track. But you're right. You know, the guys over the loudspeaker at Mid-Ohio, I will have to say they're okay, you know. But they tried to make this big deal about he's just not going to be able to finish this last lap. He can't do it. He doesn't have enough fuel. And I'm sitting there watching him, and I'm watching the gap, and the gap is not falling. He's not managing the fuel. He doesn't have to.
The fuel management, I think, came before that final pit stop, because that's where he had to manage it. And Mid-Ohio is one of those courses where if you can be very light on the throttle, you can still make good speed and still conserve fuel. But yeah, you have to, you know, it's very delicate on the throttle, and I've heard other people describe it, and I certainly don't have the skill level or the talent to come close. I would screw it up big time. But like you said, Scott Dixon is just that good. He can drive in that manner where he's saving fuel, but he's still fast.
Yeah. Scott Dixon, let's just be blunt. He was playing a cat and mouse game with Newgarden. Newgarden wasn't trying to pass him, like you said, on that last stint. So Dixon went into fuel saving mode and was able to get a few more laps than maybe he would have if he was trying to keep, you know, trying really hard to keep Newgarden behind him. Maybe Newgarden should have been pushing him more in those stints. But in the end, it really didn't matter, because we didn't get to see that play out. Now, if Newgarden came in and was able to pit and come out ahead of the pack like he would have, and with Dixon behind him by a few seconds,
it would have been a whole other race.
It would have been a whole other race, but I think what Dixon was setting himself up for was taking it as deep as he could so he could run as rich as he could for that last stint of the race. And Newgarden allowed him to do that. So that closing stint of the race, if Newgarden came out ahead, it still would have been a very interesting race, because I think Dixon would have caught him up.
there was one point, because I was watching on the IndyCar timing and scoring on the web, and in the final stint, there was one point where lap time slowed way down and then suddenly picked way up, and the gap between first and second, Dixon was able to maintain it at about a constant 1 second gap. Mm-hmm. No matter what happened, when whoever behind him sped up, he sped up just enough to keep about the same gap. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think he was completely toying with him.
So overall, the final results, Scott Dixon, like we said, he won. Sebastian Bourdais kept his nose clean and was able to finish second. Really good on him. I mean, that's what, he finished first in one of the races at Toronto, came here, qualified on pole, finished second. Those are good results for KV. Very good results, especially this year. So good on him. Hinchcliffe finished third. Carlos Munoz continues to impress in his rookie season with Andretti, finishing fourth. Graham Rahal, best result of the year, finished in fifth, kept his nose clean, didn't complain, didn't run into anybody, didn't run in over somebody on a restart. I'm impressed. Good job, Graham. We knew you had it in you. Will Power finished sixth, so that helps him in his championship hunt because he was the highest finisher in the championship battle. That allowed him to leap Elio Castroneves in the point standings, but Elio ended up finishing back in 19th. Ryan Hunter-Reay had a bit of a lackluster day because of his issues. He still was able to finish 10th, even though he had the drive-through and the spin. Simon Pagenaud really didn't have a great day. He finished ninth. He was able to finish ahead of Ryan Hunter-Reay, but those two need a whole lot better than ninth and tenth if they have any chance of catching the Penske's in the championship standings. Overall, Will Power leads the championship at 548 points. Elio is at 544, 4 points behind him. You have to go all the way back to 485 points and 484 points for Ryan Hunter-Reay and Simon Pagenaud. They have a ways to go to catch up with Will Power, and with only three races left. One of those, though, is that 100-point finale in Fontana.
Yeah, that's what it would take, winning that.
Well, who has the best chance of winning these final races? I mean, coming into it, let's talk about that and the permutations. So the countdown's on. 3, Milwaukee. 2, Sonoma. 1, Fontana. NFL kickoff! Woo! Milwaukee, that's an Andretti track. Ryan Hunter-Reay, I'm guessing, is going to win that race.
I think Elio will still be up there, though.
Yeah. Sonoma...
I also think Milwaukee is Power's best chance at having a problem or a poor finish.
Mm. At which one?
I would also say
Milwaukee.
Milwaukee is Power's best chance to win on an oval.
Because it drives more like a road course.
Yeah. Yep. He's done well on the short ovals, but the short ovals are just owned by Andretti this year and last year and the previous year. So I'm going to have a hard time rooting against Ryan Hunter-Reay.
You know who I'd like to see win Milwaukee? Yeah. I'd like Marco to win it because the poor guy, his luck this year, son of a bitch.
Yeah. It would be nice to see Marco break out and win a race. Sonoma.
I will say this, Mike. I don't have a hard time rooting against Ryan Hunter-Reay, although at Milwaukee I do have a hard time picking against him.
Yeah, no, agreed.
I will agree. When Ryan Hunter-Reay had his drive-through penalty, there was much rejoicing in the Patterson-Weitzel camp. just not as much of a fan. I mean, he's that American boy, but he's the American frat boy to me.
I'm right there with you. I'd rather have Newgarden than Hunter-Reay win.
Agreed.
But that's
anyway,
going into Sonoma, man, that's up in the air. I couldn't even begin to pick. Guys like Pagenaud have a really good shot there. Will Power has a really good shot there. Scott Dixon has a really good shot there.
Sonoma is going to be a Power, Montoya, Pagenaud.
Yeah. Fontana, there's another track that Montoya could win at, and I could see him winning going away.
Astronovus
okay.
That one.
If it came down to it, let's say it came down to Montoya and Elio battling for the win at Fontana, and the points...
Elio has to win. Done. Montoya has to finish second for Elio to win the championship. What does the captain do?
Or you could throw power into that situation as well. There's all sorts of scenarios that could play out that way. Mm. Don't know. I'd like to see what would happen in those sorts of situations. We don't know.
I don't think anybody at Penske. I don't think there's any real hate at Penske. Because of that, I think they're going to do what's best for the team, and that's allow one of their drivers to win the championship.
Yeah, I don't think the only hate that I remember would be when Will blocked Elio.
Yeah, there's that.
Back. But that would be about the only animosity there.
If the situation were, I'm just wondering in the minds of the Penske drivers, if it was a situation where, hey, could you do this to let Elio win the championship? Would he do it over, hey, would you do this to let Juan win the championship?
Mm-hmm. Let
Will win the championship.
No. If Montoya was in front and with a chance to win, he's going to win the race. He's not going to care. I mean, that's just flat out it.
That would be fun to see.
He's not going to do team orders. Yeah.
I think
this is Juan Montoya's there to win. He doesn't care if there's a championship online for somebody else.
I would agree with you. I would agree with you. But even hearing the any sort of rumblings of that nature and the reactions to them and. How ridiculously awesome would it be if there was that radio call? Hmm. Even if Roger got on the radio and said something as a joke, you know? Yeah, I'm fantasizing.
Speaking of Juan Montoya, he is considering doing the double next year with Indy and the whole Charlotte thing.
Cool.
So yeah, that's cool. Now,
there's been a lot of publicity about Kurt Busch attempted it. Another, when Tony Stewart and Robbie Gordon have come over from NASCAR to run it. When was the last time anybody from IndyCar has attempted to run the NASCAR piece of it?
I think that was Al Unser and Mario Andretti.
Yeah, it's a ways back.
Yeah, well, and they didn't have Coca-Cola 600 or the whatever it was equivalent at the time.
They weren't run on the same day either, yeah. I don't believe.
So, oh, fun. Yeah, don't know. But it'll be fun to see if Juan Pablo can do it and goes over there and has a little fun beating up some NASCAR boys after winning the 500 next year.
Hide the jet dryers.
Hide the jet dryers, indeed. They don't have jet dryers anymore. They've got that new system
air hog, air blaster thing. I've seen it.
Does it have a little gopher attached to it that pops out of the track and says, I'm digging?
No.
Anyway, so there's been some interesting word this past week. Simon Pagenaud is trying to get himself a seat with McLaren as a test driver for the new Honda-powered IndyCar next season. Hmm. Don't quite know how that works. I just don't really understand why you would go to an IndyCar driver to become your test driver for an F1 car that he's never driven before. But, okay.
Pagenaud's been really big with Honda, though, for a while now.
Yeah. Last year he ran the minivan, the Odyssey minivan at Pikes Peak, and done a lot of other promotional
stuff. Yep. He's their go-to Honda development, or HPD, Honda Performance Development.
Yeah.
He's their go-to guy.
Then throw this out there. Simon Pagenaud is dang good. And
yes, he is.
You want to keep him with Honda, correct? So if you don't want him driving for Penske or Ganassi next year, which I'll tell you, I would take Simon Pagenaud in a heartbeat over Ryan Briscoe. I would take him over Tony Kanaan. Wouldn't take him over Scott Dixon. I would certainly take him over, I hate to say it, I'd take
Hunter Ray?
Oh.
Newgarden?
Well, see, that's Honda, so it's not a big deal there. And we know Andretti's after him, but if there's any of the Chevy teams that are after him, isn't this a good way to keep him in the Honda camp?
Yeah.
String him along with a little F1 test.
I think the idea of Pagano going to F1, I think he is probably he's 30, I believe. I think he's maybe a little too old to have aspirations to land on the F1 grid anymore.
Clearly too late for him, so this would be more of a good job, thank you for your service.
Yeah. And from Simon's standpoint, an opportunity to do something that not too many drivers get to do.
Yeah, indeed. So five teams are packing up to head to Sonoma this week. There's open testing at Sonoma. Andretti's going to be out there. Ganassi, Rahal, Sarah Fisher, and Penske, all three drivers from Penske, all four drivers from Ganassi. Andretti, obviously, Ryan Hunter-Reay is going to be out there, as well as Carlos Munoz. Not being represented in this group, though, is Simon Pagano. They tested in the spring at Sonoma, so hopefully they have good data from that they can use. If you're looking for Simon Pagano, he and Joseph Newgarden are out at the Indiana State Fair riding the Tilt-A-Whirl and eating deep-fried monkey butts on a stick or whatever it is this year that they're selling. So
he's hanging out with Robin Miller. I've seen them posting pictures to Facebook. Miller's going to corrupt that boy, I think.
Miller corrupts everything he touches.
True.
Miller's awesome, though. I'll tell you, he used to have a quality radio program back in the Indianapolis market before podcasts, or at least before I was involved in podcasts, and it was called The Truth. And it came out of a tiny little sports talk station on the south side of Indianapolis. And to pick it up at my house on the north side of Indianapolis, I had to use one heck of a radio. Miller even referred to it in his show. If you're listening on the north side of Indianapolis, you are using your CIA radio.
Nice.
But it was equal parts comedy, equal parts bashing on IndyCar and lauding everything that CART was doing at the time. I mean, it was good stuff. Thoroughly enjoyed it. Too bad he's currently not doing a radio show, because he's high entertainment. He really is. Even if you don't agree with him. So the 2015 calendar is starting to take some form of shape. Racer just put up an article on their website that kind of hashed out some of the things we've talked about before, put in some quotes from Mark Miles in a recent interview, and here's kind of what we know. Right now they're looking at starting in Dubai, potentially early February. They've talked about whether that will be before the Super Bowl or after the Super Bowl, but certainly not on the same weekend as the Super Bowl. Interesting, though, when they said Dubai, I was thinking Dubai, we're going to the MotoGP track in Dubai, but no, they're actually looking at a street course race in Dubai. So that's the first I've heard of that. I'm like, oh, you're kidding me. You've got such a good track there. Why would you do that?
Wow.
Oh, that's suicide. Unless they can use one of those streets that drives out into nothingness, kind of like where they test the cars. You see footage like on Top Gear and stuff.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Where you have like a 2 mile long straight. That might be okay.
Well, maybe they'll do a street course on one of the islands that they've created out in the water there. Remember, they've created islands for people, and they're just these weird shapes and everything like that. Maybe they've
trees and one that looks like the continents of planet Earth.
Yeah, I believe they made an island for Michael Schumacher and gave it to him, you know, just for fun. So yes, very wealthy people there. So that has me concerned, but I'm really happy about the idea of starting the season right there around the Super Bowl. They're looking at their second race of the season being in Brasilia, and this would be at at the let me get this right here because it's a long name. It would be the Autódromo Internacional Nelson Piquet in Brasília. This is a defunct circuit that has had a significant amount of investment in it in the last few years. It is hosting – it was supposed to host an FIM bike race this past year, and it was canceled, but it's back on for next year because the renovations are currently in progress. So it's not going to be a hole in the ground, though it was, and they're fixing it. So that will be potentially March 7th and 8th, somewhere around that time frame is what they're looking for. These are not done deals, gentlemen. Nothing has been announced, and they're even some quotes from Mark Miles hinting that the buy thing is still kind of not firm.
In other words, they haven't gotten a check yet.
Yeah, send me the check. Now, I don't know about Brasília. From what I understand on Brasília, they just haven't announced it yet. They may be waiting till a little bit later to announce that portion of the schedule. Now, here's the thing that is kind of in flux. You've got a few potential races. They've talked about how many races they want on the schedule for next year. They've added two, and to get to the amount of schedules, an amount of races they said they want of like 14 or 15 race weekends, to get to that, you kind of have to drop one. And especially if you're talking about bringing in that New Orleans race, because they're still heavily talking about bringing that in. And there's some potential for that, because Toronto next year is, how do you put it, there's a question mark because they need to move the date. They can't do it on the same weekend they have in July because of Pan Am Games. So they need to move that date. Potentially, they want to move it to June. June is chock full of action, and the race weekends in June, you've got the first race is Detroit, and that's already been announced. So we know it's going to be the weekend after the 500.
They're locked into being the next race after Indianapolis.
Yeah, currently. Now, Texas has always been locked in that following weekend, and then Houston was the third weekend, or you know, the next weekend in June. If you want to move Toronto to June, you have to move one of those events or bump it completely. So I don't know what you do there. There's been some rumblings that Texas is going to go away because they're just not happy with the things that's happening in IndyCar. And that may be, but I don't think it's going anywhere. And I would
go ahead. Here's the thing about Texas. The IndyCar weekend is also partnered with a truck race, mm-hmm. Which supports which you be the judge. So the likelihood of rescheduling that, I don't know. Now, whether it goes away, that could happen too. Houston, I think that the fans would like to see that date moved. I think everybody would like to see that date moved, but I don't know when they would be able to move it within the confines of the compressed calendar that they have.
Yeah, I mean,
spring is very busy there.
Can you take Houston and Toronto and swap them and then have people in the middle of July in Houston? I don't think so.
they're talking about New Orleans, too. Okay, if you were to have you couldn't exactly use New Orleans as a fill-in spot in June either, because the climate in New Orleans is about the same as it is in Houston.
Well, and New Orleans has said specifically what they want, and they say that they want a June race as well, which is not going to happen. I mean, it just can't happen. For them, for New Orleans, it makes best sense to have a race after the major tourist season. They want a draw to the city after Mardi Gras and everything like that. And mm-hmm. I understand that, but I'll tell you, you're going to have a better event if you do it during Mardi Gras.
True.
Okay, so there's a whole lot of potential of things in flux. I mean, really, all we've learned is that Dubai is potentially going to be a street race. But still, more information than we had, and it's worth chatting about the permutations of Toronto, Texas, and Houston, and how NOLA fits in there, if it does this year or at all. Even though they have had that big press conference with IndyCar and Bobby Jindal, the governor of Louisiana, coming out there and saying they will have a 2015 date, you know, at this point, guys.
Hey, Louisiana politics has always been a lot of bluster.
Yes. Yeah, well. So those who are sitting with bated breath waiting for me to say something about Road America, Phoenix, Laguna Seca, Portland, add your IndyCar favorite track here. I just mentioned them.
And, you're right.
And I will say this, keep on dreaming. It's not happening next year, unfortunately.
And there you just named just some of the most amazing tracks, right?
I think that the schedule that we have this year and what we're going to have next year, it sounds like it's going to be similar. Mm-hmm. It really is a travesty. It's easy to put up with, a compressed schedule like this for 1 year, knowing that you're going to go into the next year with something a little bit more reasonable, a little bit more, I hate to say it, traditional, but, a longer season, which the series is capable of having and probably should have. But then we're going to get this again.
Yeah.
You know, six months off.
At least what we do have going into next year, we have one new road course. Unfortunately, it looks like another street course. I'm not gonna bash street courses just to bash them. There have been good additions of street courses to the schedule, but street courses like Long Beach, like Toronto, they're fine and dandy, and they may make good events. But in the end, you know what?
Bring in crowds, but it's not good racing.
It's not good racing. It's yeah. a lot of carnage. It's a lot of beating mm-hmm. things up and blowing up cars.
It's a concrete tunnel.
Yeah, and yep. It's just not good racing. So I was really sad to hear that Dubai was not going to be on the road course in Dubai.
I want more road courses, not street courses.
Yeah. So the only other thing to say about IndyCar this evening before we talk briefly about the race results from Mazda Road to Indy, the only other thing to say is our next event will be Milwaukee. We have an off week before that, so we'll catch the preview for Milwaukee next week. And let me give you a preview of the preview. Ryan Hunter Ray wins.
There we go.
So, Mazda Road to Indy, a few things going on. Number one, let's talk about the race results briefly. Man, there were three USF 2000 races this weekend. And, yeah, as far as results go, RC Anderson won the first race. Edison won the second race. And Latour won the third race.
It was interesting to note that races one and three, the podiums were almost mirrors of one another. It's like you shook up the podium from race one and, threw it out on the table, however they landed. That was race three.
I will say about the USF 2000 races, pretty full fields and some pretty yes. interesting races. Some good dicing, watching it back and forth. Just too much action to really talk about. And, Doug's the guy who needs to be talking about it, and unfortunately, I'm not him. Pro Mazda race one, Nicholas Costa won for Pelfrey. Pro Mazda race two, Garrett Grist won for Andretti. Again, some good racing there. Indy Lights races one and two, Jack Harvey won them both in front of a massively expanded field of 11 cars over the previous races where we've had down to like seven. So good on Indy Lights for getting a higher car count. And there were two more cars in the paddock this weekend. They had the show car, the Indy Lights show car that they had out at Indy this year. They had that at the track, and then they had the car that they're using for testing. They had that at the track as well, all done up in road course trim because they had just tested it last week at Putnam Park, and they're bringing it here. Connor Daly and Tristan Vaudier were going to put in some laps at Mid-Ohio on Monday with the car. They did go out and do some testing with the carbon fiber version of the chassis with no paint, and they were able to quickly get under, there was quickly able to get a half second under the qualifying times of the cars for this weekend.
Wow.
Yeah. So right out of the box, you're showing good pace with it, and it's only going to get faster as they develop the car. So good deal there. The new chassis is coming on board. Rahal Letterman made comments this week that they're considering getting back into lights. So that's Rahal Letterman and Foyt considering getting back into lights. Some others are talking about it. Some teams from USF 2000 and Pro Mazda are talking about jumping up into Indy Lights. So there's at least some buzz about this chassis. You know,
it looks pretty.
It looks pretty. Good amount of boost. You know, the guys who were in the car, they're like, man, this is proper with the turbo kicking in. This is a fun car to drive.
How does it sound?
I didn't hear it, so I haven't listened to any of the videos on it either. But so I can't speak to that. But they were saying it felt nice to drive this car. So very cool, and it will be a breath of fresh air. I mean, it's really easy to understand how this car could come in and be better at Mid-Ohio on lap times out of the box because it is a purpose-built road course car. With some oval capabilities instead of being a purpose-built oval car that they over time developed.
So much easier going the other way.
Yeah, indeed. Shares a lot of the design features of the IndyCar chassis, and it'll be fun to see this going forward, and hopefully we'll have more than, you know, 7, 8, 9 cars next year.
Hopefully.
So that's the Mid-Ohio weekend and all the things that we got to see with the Mazda Road to Indy, with World Challenge, with the IndyCar race. And now's the time of the show. We turn it over. We veer off into the woods as Mike Shaw yells across the radio, right six, don't cut.
Yes, the Rally World. What a great Finland. I mean, it is the Grand Prix of Rally, and that was this last weekend. It's a 4-day event, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then 3 short stages on Sunday. Jeez. But it's just crazy wild. They didn't have the full Unimpoja famous stage that is full of so many jumps. They used a section of it. They gave it a different name. I can't remember what it's called off the top of my head because they're all Finnish names that I couldn't pronounce very well anyway. But it was a phenomenal, phenomenal race. To give you an idea, day one, first of all, was in the wet. They start off with reverse order of or in championship order. So Ogier has a start on the road, but the wet kind of helps you a little bit in that case. Normally you're sweeping the road clean. But in this case, if it's wet out, there's not as much sweeping that takes place because the rain ends up kind of binding some of that dirt to the gravel and whatnot, right? So you don't have as bad of that. But really, from the get-go, it was still, you know, a Volkswagen event. They've got the most powerful machine out there right now. And Jari-Matti Latvala, right from the get-go, pulled away from Ogier. Not a lot, but he was winning the stages on day one. But hot on his heels at the end of day one, only 4.5 seconds separating him was Sebastian Ogier. And not too far behind him, actually, was Citroën's Chris Meek. So to have that close of a 1-2-3 at the end of day one was pretty darn exciting to see how the rest of the event was going to turn out. And then you had the mid-pack after that. It was about 20 seconds farther back from that. You had Mikko Hirvonen, Juho Hanninen, Andreas Mikkelsen, Mads Osberg, and Thierry Neuville. That whole group of 5 drivers were within about a 12-second span of each other. So this is some pretty darn close action going on. You move into day two, and that's when it really starts getting to be a longer event. Because there's only, again, just a few stages on the first day, and then they end up doing the longer days are day two, which is Friday, and day three, which is Saturday. So they end up doing, how many stages was it on day two? I'm not going to remember. Anyway, everything dries out, and Ogier is at the front. This time he's having to kind of sweep the road because it does dry out. He's not very happy with this duty, but somebody's going to always have an advantage in rally, you know, unlike a tarmac event. Well, even then, the lead driver actually has an advantage in a tarmac event because as they cut corners into the grass, it puts debris onto the road. But unlike road course and street driving, you know, it's pretty much the same every time. But when you're doing rally, there's always an advantage based on position. And so because you're leading the points in the championship, you automatically get the disadvantage of being first on the road, at least for the gravel rounds. Coming up for the tarmac rounds, you get a little bit of an advantage, but there aren't many tarmac rounds there. So there's only 3 of them. So Ogier was a little vocal about having to lose time on Saturday or on Thursday, because he was, even though they had a couple of short stages on Thursday, it wasn't quite enough kilometers where they would have reseeded for Friday. And that's what kind of pissed him off. Mm. And so even though he was right up there in the front and should have maybe been put farther back, he still had to start cleaning the road. So Latvala still starts to really pull away here, pulls 21 seconds away ahead of Sebastian Ogier. And even actually Chris Meek pulls ahead into second at the end of day two on Friday there, ahead of Sebastian Ogier. So Ogier is actually in third, not a position he's used to being in. Again, that next group back, you end up having more of a group of three. You start having some attrition happen to people, inexperienced drivers slowing down just a little bit because of all the crazy jumps and blind crests on the road. Andreas Mikkelsen, Mads Osberg, Mikko Hirvonen are still battling it out, the three drivers within now 4.5 seconds of each other. So that's quite the battle for a third place going on there for a bit, or for fourth place. Move on into day three. And, you know, the start order, which is Saturday, ends up going based on your position in reverse order. So now Latvala, who's in the lead, ends up being the last one of the top group driving. So he doesn't have to worry about any road cleaning. Ogier is just right in front of him, or just two cars in front of him. Meek's in a good position as well. And by the end of day three, everything was looking great for Latvala. He was pulling ahead. He had over 30 seconds ahead of Ogier and was just starting to stretch his legs. Then about midday through, after the last service, the next stage, all of a sudden he starts hemorrhaging a little bit of time. And he doesn't say much at the stage end, but you end up hearing that he's got a brake problem.
Uh-oh.
So here he had this 30-plus second lead, and then you're sitting there on the edge just listening to every stage. How much time is he going to lose to Ogier? And here comes Ogier every stage. Like, this is when he's got a chance to push and put pressure on him. Latvala's got three brakes at work. One of them is in one of his front brakes just is completely nothing. And by the end of day three, 3.4 seconds separates first and second. So Chris Meek decides, you know what? I'm happy in third. I'm not going to try and push it any farther. Be up there with the world champion and the others with more experience. Being in the third position, that hopefully will solidify my seat with Citroën for next year. Mikko Hirvonen, on the other hand, he just kind of wasn't on pace. He just kind of lost it a bit on that last day. He ends up being 53 seconds back from the, he's like a minute back from the leaders. Andreas Mikkelsen, same thing. He's a teammate with the other VW guys there. Also more than a minute back. So kind of lackluster from those guys. But you go into day four, and there's three short little stages, and you know, 3.5 seconds separating them. One short, one's about 20 kilometers, and then another short one ends up being the power stage. And you're just watching to see, is Ogier going to outdo Latvala? And Latvala, he's right at home. These are actually mostly new stages out at this event. They said that 80% of the stages were new for most of the drivers. They hadn't run some of them since 2008. But being the home country of where Jari Matti Latvala is from, he knows these roads pretty well, and he was able to, in the end, pull out the win by a mere 3.6 seconds at the end.
Wow.
So that's a pretty darn close finish. It was great to see such excitement in rally. Again, we've had these kind of close calls, maybe not at the finish, but, you know, other parts of rally events, and, you know, it just doesn't get broadcast to the world as well as it should. And it was just a really fun one to watch. There's always some sort of drama that goes on out in Finland. Again, an impressive performance by Chris Meek, ended up in third. Hyundai, they ended up doing okay, but they ended up being plagued with some bad luck. Out there where you're jumping and, you know, sliding around on the gravel, you can impact pretty hard. And apparently a rock after an impact, there was a compression and some rocks there. Thierry Neuville, who's the lead driver for Hyundai, he ended up hitting a rock that damaged his car a bit. They go back to service. He's still able to continue on. He slides too wide, kind of hits the car, and he's driving just fine, but they get into service, and they look, and there's a bend in the roll cage, and it's not in an area that you can repair. So his complete event is gone at that point. He has to retire. Similarly, Mads Osberg had an event where, he went into compression, hit a rock, and again, the smack of the rock happened to hit a part of the roll cage, bending it. And they say, you know, if the roll cage is compromised, you can't continue. And they're especially strict at Finland because the speeds are so fast. The wrecks are so violent if you get in one. They have to make sure that structure is in pristine working order. I can see maybe at some other event, maybe like, you know, you can continue on or something like that, but you just can't do that at Finland. other bad luck that happened for Hyundai, Hayden or Juho Hanninen, who's the Finnish driver for them, he ended up sliding too wide on a corner. He had some issues with his steering for a bit, and he ended up doing the slow roll in a ditch. Thankfully, spectators got him working again. After he got to the end of the stage and he couldn't see very well, they ended up kicking out the windscreen. And so they have no windshield at all. Complete open air, doing rally stages at 180 kilometers an hour. Pretty darn scary. But, you have the roll cage was in, okay, so you can continue. You don't need a windscreen. But, so that moved them back down. The young Kiwi, Hayden Padden, who's also with the Hyundai team, he was actually doing really well. He was showing that he was learning and going faster and faster. It was really fun to watch him actually as Hanninen's car got repaired. He was not only keeping pace with Hanninen, but pulling away as Hanninen was trying to catch up to him. Really, really good to see that. Unfortunately, on the final day, power steering failure for Padden. Something happened with the car. I don't know if he cut too far on an inside, clipped a rock or something, but something caused power steering to fail. And he was just wrestling with that car all day. And finally, he got passed by two other drivers and ended up finishing farther down the order. Kind of sucky when that kind of stuff happens. Overall, the stage winners, Jari Matti won almost every single stage, along with Sebastian Ogier. So those two were just trading stages. The bigger, longer stages where he could make the biggest gap was Jari Matti. There was only one stage that was won by a different driver, and that was Chris Meek on the, oh gosh, what was it? Stage 7. So one win of a stage by some other driver. But it really shows you the dominance of both Jari Matti and of Sebastian Ogier and VW as a whole when it comes to these high-speed events. If you made it more slippery and, you know, a little more compromised, I guess, conditions, we might have seen a little bit more other drivers being able to contend. As they say, you know, just add water and it'll help equalize everything. That wasn't the case here other than the first day, which really wasn't all that wet. Yeah, it was a pretty awesome thing to watch it being such a close, heated battle between the two. It was really cool to see Jari Matti's confidence. He's the guy that, under pressure, he'd usually cave and make a mistake. And he was quoted as saying, it's not about the championship, this is about Finland, and I'm here to win. I've never seen Latvala so confident and so determined ever to win a race before. So his psychological coach that he's got right now has obviously been working. And it was great to see him under pressure come across, you know, determined. Yeah, he was frustrated with the situation, but still calm, handled it, and came out dominating. Now, could this play out a little bit farther with the championship? It's hard to say. I mean, it's been said that Jari Matti is the fastest driver in the WRC. He lacks consistency, but he's the fastest driver in the WRC. Ogier's got speed and consistency, but maybe not quite the speed as Latvala. So, things that make you go,
Indeed.
So the results overall, just kind of run through them real quick. I already told you about Latvala wins, Ogier in second, Chris Meek in third, Andreas Mikkelsen, so he didn't get a full 1-2-3 with Volkswagen. He ends up in fourth. Mikko Hirvonen ends up in fifth. Juho Hanninen ends up taking the sixth away from Padden, who had earned a sixth place, but unfortunately the power steering failure killed his chances there. Elvin Evans of M Sport, the rookie there, he ends up in seventh. Hayden Padden in eighth. Henning Solberg, who unfortunately had tire change after tire change after tire change, he had punctures galore. He ended up in ninth. He was actually really on pace and really fast the first day, and then the second day, he started getting all these punctures second and third day. So I think he was used to those Pirelli tires he used to run. This time he ran on the Michelins, and the Pirellis are like, they're a heavier tire, but they're built like iron, and that helped him out a lot. And then 10th place actually went to a WRC 2 driver, Carl Kruda, so who ended up winning the WRC 2 champion or event there. One last thing I was going to say is Crazy Leo from Canada, who was there to race in the DMAC Cup. He ended up not even being able to start the event. Unfortunately, his co-driver ended up with a back injury after them doing some when they go through and they do their setups and they're doing their the tests out there. you get these jumps that are so big, and the co-drivers, they have even less suspension to the seat because they sit lower in the car. If that car bottoms out at some point, or the suspension bottoms out and it has to impact hard, that can hurt a co-driver pretty bad. I remember a Finland event about, I think it was 2004, I think it was, and WRC champion Marcus Granholm had landed really hard in the Peugeot, and his co-driver, his back was hurt so bad, and he was winded from it. The in-car, you can hear suddenly he just can't even do pace notes anymore. He's just like, it just knocked the complete wind out of him. And they finished the stage, and I think they end up just kind of retiring after that just because of the injury to the co-driver. Mm. In a similar stead, Craig Breen, who was doing in a WRC car, who's not really done much in the WRC, but he's been in the WRC 2, or he was in a junior championship a couple years back, and he's in the European championship. He got an event, he got a chance to do a WRC car in Finland. He was on the on one of the final stages, and on Friday, or on Sunday, I mean, he lands hard, I guess. At the stage end, basically, he gets out of the car real quick and starts walking around holding his back. And just kind of wincing, not saying anything to anybody, and drives off and goes straight to the medical center, and he has to retire. Just, you got to be careful about those jumps. The suspensions on the cars are amazing, but if you don't hit it right or you bottom out because you don't have the settings right, you can get seriously hurt. So anyways, that's the standings there. Moving on, we will discuss a little bit of... I lost my place, gents. I apologize.
WRC Plus.
Oh, WRC Plus. So WRC, I posted this article on our site when it was first released last week. So WRC decided they're going to do a premium content service. And with this, you would get onboards, you'd get video, and you would get a moving map of the drivers, where they're at on the stages, you know, things like that. So I definitely jumped right on it because I don't get MAV TV. And typically with a lot of this WRC coverage that comes to the States, it's a week or two or three after the event's already over. I want to know at least the day of what's been going on. I don't see this as a replacement for the live radio coverage you get with WRC Live. I see it more of an enhancement. One thing I liked about this app, it's, by the way, it's €4.99 in euros per month. I almost think they should actually charge per event. But I guess if there's 13 events, I guess technically that's cheaper. But there's going to be a gap in there. I wonder what kind of content they're going to come up with the gaps in between, you know? Mm. But as it sits, one of the things that was really neat was seeing this this map that had little icons of the car numbers as they're entering the stage. You kind of follow along when they're in the transit routes and all that stuff. You could actually see their speed and the direction they were going in the stage. So you could see like 180 kilometers an hour, and then it would suddenly go down to, you know, 100 kilometers an hour, and then down to 20, you know. Oh, there's a tight hairpin, you know. And it's all over a Google Map thing, you know. Okay, well, that's kind of neat. The problem with it is you couldn't see the name with it. You'd have to know number six. Well, who's car number six? You know, you'd have to refer to something else, and then, you know, you could click on it, but then it would kind of take you away from the other thing that you're looking at or whatever. So a little frustrating in trying to, in that they don't have it quite cleaned up as far as who to follow. One of the coolest features ended up being with the onboards. I can go in there, and I can look at an onboard of Ogier and of Latvala, set up two at the same time, and I can hit play, and it'll start them simultaneously side by side.
That's cool.
And it'll show a map off to the right-hand side of where they are. And so you can actually see in real time who's faster in what section. So that's a pretty cool feature to have. That has to be my favorite feature right now. The other feature is, of course, the videos. You get the three dailies that come out from a rally weekend, and then the one full overview that's an hour. The dailies are about 25 minutes long. And then the overview, like I said, is about an hour. This is the same exact content, though, that you get from something else. So it's nothing special. For those that don't have the ability to see this content, I think it's a great feature. And for me, it's worth my money to get it. I'm still wanting a little bit more. The other big disappointment out of this, as far as the stuff I was looking for, is you only saw the top WRC teams in the moving map. It didn't include any of the WRC2. It didn't include any of the WRC3, the Junior WRC, or the Drive DMAT Cup drivers. So if I wanted to see how, you know, the guy that's closest to me, you know, crazy Leo Ulrichich, who's from Canada that I've met, talked to before, he's a great guy. I'm like, wow, I want to see how he's doing over there. Guess what? Nothing. You can't follow him. So
that's a shame.
They need to expand it. What's that?
Oh, no, I was saying that's a shame that you don't have access to the full lineup of drivers and their status.
Right. And if I'm going to pay for premium content, I want premium features. You know, I mean, that's the end of story. The moving map thing is a cool thing. We've been asking for that actually on their main WRC site. These are mostly features that everybody's been talking about for the main WRC site that should have been for free for forever. But whatever. I guess the main thing that they've got going for them would be the onboards that you can see with the side-by-sides, the videos for people that can't get them through, you know, TV, and stuff like that. The map thing is cool. It just doesn't cover everything, which is where I find some frustration with that, especially since they don't cover that on the radio as much because those guys have to go from stage end to stage end. They don't cover it on the television product very well. So I want some sort of expanded feature if I'm paying money, and covering those lower classes would be a good way to do that.
Makes sense.
So if you don't get coverage, I would say give the WRC Plus premium content a try. You know, I think it's pretty neat. It was fun to be able to go back and rewatch the live stages that they're now starting to show. You get to watch those. I woke up at 3 a.m. to watch the power stage. And because it was so close between Latvala and Ogier, I was glued to it, and it was exciting and fun to watch. But there's the other big, you know, kicker for that. You get the live stages, you get the video content of the dailies, and you get the onboards with the side-by-side comparison, which is the best feature of that. So needs improvement is what I'd give it. Cool product, needs improvement. The only other thing I'll say about it is I'm a little concerned of the direction of stuff like this going towards premium pay-per-service things, in that recently, do you guys ever follow the Drive Network?
Yes.
On YouTube? Okay. Drive, and no fault of their own, Drive Network is brilliant. They do a great job of doing all these car videos and whatnot, and they were part of YouTube and Google's had a special thing where they're trying to create these special content channels, and they were actually giving money to help produce them. Well, they cut funding for that. They said, well, this is a great experiment. By the way, you get no more money. So these channels that have become very successful, they still don't necessarily get over the million views per video they put on there, which is where you really start to make money. And you have to understand, any of the advertisements and whatnot, they're sharing that money with Google. They only get a percentage of that. So their revenue isn't quite as high as you might think. And so to provide this, you know, good quality content, they've now switched to where they have a premium service as well for the Drive Network. Google is experimenting with a premium service that you can do for certain channels. It gets kind of tough to the point that all the stuff that you want to see becomes a pay-per-service. I like the a la carte concept, but the cost is a little too high, in my opinion. You start doing $5 a month for each one of the things. Heck, I could get HBO and Showtime and all that stuff for that on my, you know, on my and my cable provider and all that stuff. And, you know, so I just caution the direction of this pay for this premium service stuff, unless they add to it content that is just amazing. If it's just basically rehashing stuff that I just couldn't get through my cable provider, it's a little bit harder to swallow. So they need to really up the game, in my opinion, to make it a worthwhile tool. I said my piece on it. Next thing that was also going on in Rally Finland was the introduction of yet another GT86 rally car. But this wasn't just any GT86 rally car. Mm-hmm. Oh, no. This was an all-wheel drive version built by none other than Tommy Mäkinen himself, the four-time WRC champion. Him and his team that pioneered making the R4 conversion, I believe, for the Subarus, they created a GTA6 WRC, they called it, specifically for Toyota-san himself. Mr. Toyota, he's a rally fan and fanatic through and through. You gotta love the guy. But this is a turbocharged car, Although it does have the standard transmission, but it was all-wheel drive, and not too many bells and whistles in there, but it did have a little bit of extra power. And it's just a badass looking little machine, and I would love WRC to allow this spec of car to run. According to Mr. Toyota himself, he said, "I came here to learn about WRC, but what I found out is that Toyota's DNA of rally is really, really a lot to me. As a top guy of the company, I want to continue that kind of legend. But Toyota's a big company, and nobody listens to the president. So I have to show everyone that Toyota needs rally to make ever better cars. The main objective is to make the car to make car fans and make ever better cars. In the first part of the year, I met Tommy in Japan. He invited me to see WRC and recommended I should drive in Finland, where there are lots of interesting roads. Also, I asked him to make a car for me, and that's this red one that he drove and I co-drove. But for me, no notes. I just enjoy. I'm the luckiest person to see the WRC from that kind of seat." if you go to WRC.com, there's pictures of the car. There's a YouTube a video that WRC has up of Tommy Mäkinen driving it. But Toyota himself actually, on a previous day, got to go and drive it a little bit on some of the stages. It's just a badass-looking car. I think it would bring some excitement back to the sport versus all the current cars look the same. They really do. Sure, the Volkswagen looks a little bit different with its, you know, headlamps and whatnot. But if you made the cars all black and covered up all the lights and you set them all side by side and you did a profile view, would you be able to tell one apart from the other?
Nope.
Exactly.
They're all hot hatches of some sort.
Yes, they're hot hatches, but not only they're hot hatches, but they're, I mean, the dimensions are exactly the same. I mean, there isn't much differentiating them. I'm excited to hear what comes out of the 2017 spec that they're hoping to release by the end of the year. If they allow a 2-liter car like this GT86 with some other restrictions on it, but I mean, it's already a heavier car because it's bigger, so it's already got a bit of a disadvantage. I hope the enticement of bringing in another manufacturer like Toyota helps push forward changes in those regs to allow an expansion. There we go. Now, what do you guys think? Would you like to see it?
I'm a Toyota fan in general, so as well as a fan of the GT86 platform. I'm all for it.
And along that same GT86 front, because, you know, everything's all about the GT86 right now when it comes to rally these days as far as new and exciting. You know, last week I told you about Germany. There's going to be debuting the Tarmac one that's been built by TMG, yes. I believe it is, which is Toyota's former WRC manufacturer from back in the day. And that'll be in Tarmac spec. It'll be their it'll be the WRC3 class car. It'll still be just rear-wheel drive. But the nameless GT86 we had here in the States that I got to see up in Washington a couple of years ago, it will return. Oh, yes, it will return.
Oh, yes.
I believe, John, you actually heard a little bit about this, too.
Somebody I talked to kind of loosely on one of the Jalopnik subsites. Somehow we were talking about the GT86 platform, and that was a question that was raised. And they're going to be back at
LSPR.
I forget where. I'm sorry, where?
Lake Superior Performance Drive, Lake the last Superior. One of the season, okay. LSPR.
So yeah, I don't think I know any more than you do. I think I sent you a little snippet of the conversation where it was discussed, and you certainly sounded like you knew about that and perhaps a bit more.
Yeah. I had been on Facebook and whatnot. I know some people actually over at Nameless. I actually had a good conversation with one of the co-owners of the business. And, he actually, co-drove out at, Oregon Trail, and him and I were chatting quite a bit. And, the main thing is it's not just that the car wasn't ready. They had some engine damage and some adjustments that, you know, it's still a test platform really for their design. And unfortunately, or fortunately, however you want to put it, their business at Nameless has exploded. They've been working on getting a new, expanding their manufacturing. So they got a brand new warehouse. They're trying to get the loan done and all that stuff. And quite honestly, they've been working overtime every week. I mean, everybody's putting in 80 hours a week, trying to get all of these parts they're doing, because they got this deal at the end of the year last year with Cosworth. where Cosworth is selling Nameless Performance Parts. And it's not like, you know, it has to go by the Cosworth name. It's actually Nameless, you know, just selling through Cosworth's channels. I think it's, yeah, Nameless by Cosworth, or Cosworth by Nameless or something. Anyways, so I get their name all over the parts. And one thing that really hit them was post-tax season. Everybody had their tax returns and wanted parts for their cars. And just the small outfit that they are, they just weren't expecting the business they were going to get. And so really, they've been just making money, busy making money and not having time to play with the car. So finally, things, I think, are starting to catch up. They're moving into their new space, and they'll have some new employees to help make those new parts. And so LSPR, which is the last one of the season for Rally America, gives them an opening to bring the car back. So really excited to see that.
They have the 400-plus horsepower turbocharged?
Yep, they got a twin-scroll turbocharger in there. It's a beast of a machine. I mean, they had issues with cooling. When I was up there at Olympus, or at that time it was called the Nameless Rally, because they couldn't use an Olympus name, if you remember that whole drama. Anyway, they melted the fan on the front of the car, because where the turbo pipe came up, the exhaust from it, was just so hot, so close to the plastic fans that are typical, you know, on a smaller car. It just melted the fan. It was funny. So, you know, little tweaks and changes that they need to adjust to make that, you know, put in some heat shielding and things like that, that you only really learn by running it, you know. But, yeah, it's got a lot of power. That thing's got a lot of power. It sounds beautiful. Riger suspension, I believe, all around. Just a great machine. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how much he wins by at LSPR. Because Will Orders, who's the Australian driver that piloted it last time, he's not slow. If they don't have any mechanicals, he should be up there with the open class in speed. So, other news in the rallycross world, WRX, not as in the Subaru, but as in the World Rallycross Championship, is coming to North America. Because it is FIA sanctioned now, and therefore they must make a stop in North America to be considered a world championship, right? Mm-hmm. Unlike stuff that's here in the United States, where we can call something a world championship and just do one stop in Canada.
True, you know. Hey, why not? Hey, NFL crowns a world champion every year, and they're kind of right, because we really only play that game here in the States, and sometimes in London.
Yeah, I was hearing about the London concept that they're thinking about doing there. So, yeah, it sounds like the World Rallycross Championship is coming here. 29 of the supercars are going to make it across pond over here, as well as 10 that'll be the RX lights, which is similar to the GRC lights. It's that same platform, which actually some of the fun cars to watch. Interestingly, we do have some of the American GRC drivers that are going to be up there. You will have Tanner Faust is going to be up there with his Volkswagen, and Subaru, actually, Subaru is not in the World Rally or WRX, the World Rally Cross Championship. They're not really into that, but they are going to make a showing at this World RX of Canada. So they'll have Saveri Isaacson will be up there. He used to compete in the Rally Cross Championship up there when it was just the European Rally Cross Championship. So very interesting to see how that goes down with some of the guys that are been driving the shorter tracks here in the States do well, you know, see how well they do up in those at the more dedicated tracks that they have for the Rallycross Champion. This one specifically is going to be at the Grand Prix Trois-Rivières in Quebec, Canada. So if I could do it, I'd go up there only because I would really like to meet Petter Solberg, because he's like one of my like rally heroes. And he's got a badass car. If you've ever seen his PSRX rallycross car, that thing is a freaking beast. Not that all the cars don't have like 600 horsepower, but there's something special about his when you see it go. It's just a monster of a car and fun to watch. So keep tuned in to actually the Rallycross RX website. They will actually have live streaming that they do because they're on the front end of this stuff, as is World Rally Championship now with their premium content and Pirelli World Challenge. These are smart people that realize the internet is actually a viable solution for broadcasting motorsports. So there. So yeah, if you go to rallycrossrx.com. There'll be a link to the live broadcast of that. And it's actually a pretty good program. I've enjoyed it this season. And last little bit, the Red Bull GRC, they had a mid-season review that they did on NBC on Sunday. I watched some of it, but I was like really tired after doing literally hours and hours of yard work. And I ended up not catching the whole thing. But you can watch it again this coming Saturday or Friday night, actually, I think it is. It'll be on 10:30 p.m. Pacific. And it's an hour and a half long, so they'll have a lot more content. Some of it's just rehashing. What I saw so far was just rehashing stuff I'd already seen. But I've been hearing they do have some expanded content in the middle of it. More of the lights coverage, which, I've found to be some of the better racing. They call it the mid-season review. It is technically the mid-season for the Red Bull GRC. But I think the best part of the season is going to be the second half. Charlotte was a good track with all the dirt there. I like the DC track a bit. New York wasn't so much fun, and because I just thought it was too short. And X Games was laughable. But, you know, they're, again, newer series, they're still kind of building their pace. We'll see how that goes. But they don't have another event till the end of the year, so or the end of the month. See, it's getting too late for me, guys. So that would be it for Rallycross coverage and rally coverage in general. If you didn't pay attention to what happened with Finland, then sucks to be you because it was freaking awesome.
Yeah. All right. Well, that wraps up the rally portion of the program. We've covered our major topics for this evening, and I guess I have to ask, are there any last shout-outs before we wrap the show for the night? And that's a no.
That's a no.
One thing we didn't talk about the IndyCar portion of the podcast, and we'll bring it up now, is the continued debacle of the Trackside on online podcast. Yeah. This is a frustrating deal. Yes, it's free. You can go to the web and get this podcast for free. It's a wonderful thing, and it's a really good radio show. Kurt Cavan and Kevin Lee do a phenomenal job. Kevin Lee is a professional broadcaster. Kurt Cavan, not so much, but he does a great job bringing good information and good interviews and all of that. Kurt Cavan is the Indianapolis Stars beat writer for the IndyCar series, and the only one out there, really, that is a newspaper beat writer. There are a few newspapers that have guys that occasionally cover IndyCar, but this is the only dedicated dude out there that does it. This podcast has been up for several years. It's a fantastic program. It's impossible for me to listen to it on, over the radio because obviously I'm a bit too far from Indianapolis. It's a nice service that they put it out to podcast. Problem is they pulled the podcast feed. They pulled the iTunes feed, and now you have to go to SoundCloud and download individual programs as an MP3, put it on your device and listen to it through an audio player, just like you're listening to, you know, music files or what have you. But even more difficult because it's not something that's easy to sync. A few more steps, kind of a pain that you can't just automatically download it now while you sleep.
Or you stream it through their website. But yeah, there's no means of automatically obtaining.
I think that's what they're doing, right? Aren't they trying to just push you to, you have to do it through their website so you see their ads on their site or something? I think that's kind of the direction that some places are going to. And it's kind of sad to see because, yeah, you remove the convenience and the bottom line is I'm just not going to listen at all then. Yeah. I don't have the time to sit in front of my computer that frequently. The occasion, I will have my, my Chrome on my phone can play, you know, files from a website fine, I guess. But, you know, as soon as you exit that and go to do something else, it'll stop playing. And it's just very frustrating. And I just don't like the direction they're going. And the, you're talking about the SoundCloud. What sucks about SoundCloud is when I was looking this up with you, you told me about this. When you want to select the program that you want to add to your SoundCloud, it includes everything. You can't select just that one specific program from that station. Mm-hmm. You have the whole damn station, right? So it's going to alert you about every one of their sub-programs when all you want to hear is that one specific show.
Yeah, so you're getting all the local sports talk. And not everybody's terribly interested in that. So,
What they don't seem to realize is that the trackside program specifically, it really transcends the local Indianapolis market just because of the unique nature of the two personalities that do it and their insight into IndyCar. There's not another show like it that really covers a racing series in the manner that they do and from the perspective that they're able to.
Kind of, yeah, it's unfortunate that we're kind of being forced to do things a different way or just abandon the program. And unfortunately, I'm in a realm where I have lots of decisions of what I can listen to on my phone. I don't have unlimited time to listen to stuff on my phone. It's fairly easy for me to download books from the library, put them on my phone through the OverDrive app, and listen to a book. It's really dang easy for me to go through and set up whatever podcast I like to listen to. There's a whole host of genres of stuff that I enjoy, and I've got podcasts from every single one of them that I enjoy listening to. Please explain to me why I'm going to make extra effort every week to download the program, hope it comes. And that's the other thing. This podcast doesn't come out frequently. Shouldn't say that. It doesn't come out on a regular schedule. Most of the time it runs on Tuesday nights. But you get around Pacers games and Colts games and, well, Colts not so much, but Pacers games and various programs that end up on that sports talk station. It means the program moves around. Maybe it's on Thursday this week. Maybe it's not playing that week. And
let's not forget that also during the month of May, as well as in the lead up to the Brickyard 400, they do their show nightly.
Mm-hmm. Talk of Gasoline Alley is also done, will be done through SoundCloud, I'm assuming, because that's something that they put on their station. So this is very frustrating for IndyCar fans. And yes, there's an easy workaround. Obviously, yeah, I can go to their website and download the individual MP3s. They tried breaking it up into six MP3s, and people complained about it, but they broke it up into six MP3s because people were complaining that they were, when they stopped streaming it, they couldn't just start again where they left off. So they're like, well, we can fix that by giving you six MP3s that you can start and stop and still,
you know,
lose your place.
The whole gist of this, or the whole reasoning behind the radio station's decision to do this, is ad revenue. Well, you know what, when they do the show live over the air, they have advertisements in there. Mm-hmm. You want ad revenue, keep those ads in the podcast and, you know, make it available. Now, I actually looked into this. SoundCloud has their podcasting tools that they have for the broadcasters. They have the ability to publish to iTunes. They have the ability to publish an RSS feed. It's a decision by the radio station or their technical people or their web people or somebody in that decision-making process to specifically not make their content available through iTunes or through RSS feeds or whatever other distribution channel.
But even then, you know, if they gave an RSS feed for it or an iTunes feed, it's going to be 1070 the Fan RSS feed, and it's going to be everything they do on their website, or at least currently that's how they're set up with SoundCloud. Everything's going to one big group of 1070 the Fan files. So I don't know.
I'm certain there would be a way for them to segment that out if they choose to. And the question is whether or not they choose to.
Yeah.
Right now, I think the web the web people or whoever is making the decision at the website is that, you know what, we can use SoundCloud as a dumping ground for all of this stuff, so we don't have to deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy for me to come here and complain about this. And part of the reason I am is because, man, I've been using podcasts for a long time, and not iTunes. I've never even used iTunes. I've always used the standalone applications. My favorite was Podcatcher on a Stick. That thing was an awesome little program. Every time you plugged in your MP3 player into your computer, it automatically launched its podcast manager software and started downloading new files. It was a great little piece of software, and sit right on my little MP3 player. Perfect thing. And I've been dealing with this stuff for a long time, playing with these podcasts for a long time. I'm an enthusiast. I enjoy these podcasts. It's part of the reason I got into, you know, the Open Paddock site, and we started doing a podcast here, is because I'm just an enthusiast for this stuff. I enjoy it. I'm glad there's programming in my niche, in the things I enjoy. I enjoy some obscure racing series, so I can listen to podcasts about racing series. Name any obscure fandom, anything you want. There's something out there for you to listen to, targeted directly at you. So this is taking this thing that I've enjoyed for several years, this DVR'd radio, basically, and it's making it very difficult again. And it doesn't make any sense why that decision is being made. I understand they want to drive clicks to their site. Maybe that isn't the best goal for them, though, because they've already got listeners. They already hear 1070 The Fan all the time, and you have the ability to serve ads to these listeners, and you're not.
Yep.
Oh, well.
Anyway. You know, and it's not a question of, because I believe they are an ESPN radio affiliate, are they not?
I do not know for sure. I think they are.
I think so. Yeah, because I know the ESPN, other ESPN affiliates in other markets, they have other content that they publish. So it's not a question of ESPN or their corporate partners saying, no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
In fact, speaking of podcasts that you automatically download, my app that does that for me downloads one from the ESPN affiliate out of Austin. And they do a lot of stuff with Circuit of the Americas and events there, and people that are coming to the circuit to test and whatnot. So, but it's not anything that ESPN is saying, no, this is, we have rights to this content, you can't publish it. This is something that the radio station themselves and their management and whoever it is that's involved in that decision making process, but it's at the station level. And I think it's a poor decision.
Well, all that said, thank you for listening to Open Paddock. We know you have many options for your listening pleasure, and again, we thank you for sitting with us through another rant through the world of motorsports this evening. Hopefully 1070 The Fan realizes what we perceive as a mistake, and then they move back to allowing RSS and iTunes access to their podcast. But if they don't, we'll be here for you, and we thank you for choosing to spend your time with us again this evening. Again, I'm Mike Weitzel with John Olsikowski and Mike Shaw saying good night. Thank you.